Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
From Nice Guy Productions world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is the fun size edition of Postmortem AMA, where you can ask me anything. And asking your questions is producer Joe Russo. Joe, how are you?
I'm good, Mick. It's good to be back. We had a long extended AMA absence while we celebrated Halloween.
We had people who had questions to answer that were much more important than me.
I mean, what a run, though. I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis and Tommy Lee Wallace. And
you Ray had to Lee have Lee as a middle name to be on. Yeah.
That's right. Yes. Yes. And support the Halloween franchise. No, it was fun. It was we had such a great run of episodes, and I'm excited to get back into AMAs to close out the season.
Me too. Yeah, yeah, we're getting close to the end of the year.
Yes, absolutely.
We'll see what happens beyond that.
Yeah, we've got a couple fun guests left in the queue. So, all right, questions?
I'm ready.
All right. Travolta Jedi Trekkie 1996 writes.
I'm not going to answer a question from him or her.
Yes, you are.
Oh,
because
okay.
It's called Ask Mick Anything.
Anything.
All right, here we go. With MGM relaunching Orion Pictures, United Artists, and American International, if you could bring back one defunct movie company, what would it be?
It's a really easy one, because I used to work for Avco Embassy at the time that they did The Fog, Scanners, Escape from New York, The Howling, Phantasm, all of these great, great genre films. You know, Avco did a wonderful job. And then when Bob Ramey left Avco Embassy to run Universal, Avco just kind of lost their horror roots and kind of disappeared completely. But they would be great to bring back.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, and what a run. Like, the list of movies you just listed, like, what a run, you
it
know?
It was pretty amazing.
I mean, that's within 5 years, all those pictures.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Pretty impressive. That
was within 2 years, those pictures.
Wow. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it was 80 and 81.
Wow. That Avco Embassy t-shirt that you and I both have.
Yeah, that you got for me as
right.
a birthday gift,
that's
which
right.
was very kind of you. Thank you.
Well. My pleasure. I was wearing it at a coffee shop a couple weeks ago, and the barista he basically was like, "So you going to Beyond Fest?" And I was like, "That's like what a random question." I was like, "Yes, of course." I was like, "But what made you like prompt that?" He's like, "Your T-shirt. You're wearing an Avco Embassy T-shirt."
Yeah, it wasn't a The Graduate fan, which was yeah. the first of the Avco Embassy releases.
Yeah, so I thought that was funny that like the horror community knows that brand, yeah. and it is kind of iconic in that way. You
it
know?
Certainly is, and it was really a thrill to be a part of that.
I bet it was. So yeah, I think I'd love to see it come back. I think that'd be great.
Yeah.
All right. Mark wants to know, what are some truly great micro-budget horror films?
Well, there are the biggies, of course. There's Blair Witch,
yes.
Which changed the course of cinema with its found footage format.
We've never really talked about Blair Witch that much before, you and I. What was it like when you saw it? Like, what were the contexts of you seeing it?
I actually saw it on video. My agents at the time sent it over for me to look at.
Oh, wow.
So I didn't see it in a theater, but watching it on video, because it's shot on video, and yeah, it's like a videotape that's found footage, kind of the father of the found footage movies.
Yeah.
It was incredibly effective. I thought it was amazing. I know a lot of people now, because it's been so common, it doesn't have the power that it did then, being the first in line.
Right.
But I was really impressed by it.
Yeah, yeah. I saw it under the pretenses that it was real. And
yeah, well, that's the way you should know, see it, yes, feeling that it's
and,
real.
And I'm trying, I can't remember exactly, because that was 1999, right?
Yes,
so I must have just started high school. So yeah, I mean, it was like, it was a biggie, you know?
Yeah.
And is a biggie. And then of course,
Paranormal Activity came along and also continued that found footage, but in a little more polished way.
Yep.
And so that changed a lot of things.
But made for even less money than Blair Witch originally, which is...
Right, yeah, right. Until it sold to DreamWorks, yeah, and then
Jason Blumenthaler
pumped
some money into it. Yeah, exactly. Which was a well-documented story on our Oren Peli episode, which people should hunt down from 5 years ago.
Now that he's pretty much retired from filmmaking.
I mean, you know what? If you win the lotto, right?
Yeah. Well, I would still...
Yeah,
do what I
you know what? I think I probably would too.
Yeah.
But
more power to him.
Yeah,
you know, he was a successful software engineer before he made Paranormal Activity, so he already had a pretty good life.
Yeah,
and then his life changed even more profoundly.
And now he lives out in New Zealand, and he seems very happy about
it. Yeah,
he's avoiding our horrible political situations
and posting beautiful pictures of his beautiful life.
Yes, yes, which I watch very enviously.
But also, I think even every bit as impressive and maybe not quite as well known are the films of like Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson.
Yes,
who've
also
done movies like The Endless and their most recent one, it's brand new release now, is Something in the Dirt, which is incredibly impressive as well. They star in most of their own movies.
Yes.
They write and direct together. They do their own visual effects and cinematography, and they do really polished, smart, unique films, all with a kind of a science fiction twist to them, but set in a very real world, not spaceship sci-fi.
Yeah, then they're really, and they're really,
really scientific.
Then they're really great guys too.
And their work is great, and they too have been on the show, and you should check that one out if you're interested. But check out Something in the Dirt. So there's some good examples of some micro.
I'll throw one more at you.
Okay.
Host.
We
love
great.
Host.
Great. Okay, yes. That's one of the best ever.
Yeah,
And not the Korean movie, which is also fantastic.
Yes,
but not a low budget found footage film. But to play it all on a computer screen, it's genuinely suspenseful, genuinely frightening. It's a true horror film filled with great ideas, great performances, and all plays out on a computer screen. So I was blown away by that one.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's. I'm very excited to see what that creative team is cooking up next, especially Rob. He's doing the Stephen King adaptation of Boogeyman.
Yeah.
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 So.
No, I'm always eager to see new stuff by people who've been able to create something special on a dime.
Me too. All right. The Shrimp Shack Slasher wants to know.
I'm not going to answer that one.
Yes, you are.
Okay.
All right.
You're such a taskmaster.
I am. That's why I'm producer Joe. All right. The Shrimp Shack Slasher wants to know, with Mick being a musician and music playing important roles in his movies, what is one of his favorite needle drops in another horror movie?
Well, Blue Moon in An American Werewolf in London is classic. There are a bunch of them, but that's the first one that comes to mind. And in fact, An American Werewolf in London has several moon-oriented songs in it, and they all work great, and it's a great theme that Landis pulled off. But that would be the first one that comes to mind.
And it is a classic one at that. All right. Mark has a question about sleepwalkers.
Oh, dear.
He asks, do you think the film is thematically about trying to maintain your innocence, trusting someone with bad intentions, and putting your family above everyone else? What do you think, Mick?
Well, it is to a certain extent, and it is about trusting someone who feels trustworthy and finding out that they are not. It is innocence versus the opposite of innocence, which isn't experience necessarily. We're talking about characters who've had to wear disguises for hundreds of years, if not thousands, versus a virginal young woman in Midwestern United States. So that theme is an important one to that. So I would have to go along with with Mark.
Yeah. Oh, good. Mark, your reading of Sleepwalkers is accurate. Demir writes, you've adapted Stephen King, Clive Barker, and Mick Garris. Are there any other authors you're dying to adapt for film and television?
Well, I almost adapted some things by several different authors, like Richard Matheson and some other people. But the closest was I almost did Clandestine, a novel by James Ellroy, who's an amazing author.
L.A. Confidential.
L.A. Confidential is magnificent, and yes. Black Dahlia is just mind-bending. Those three books are incredibly good.
Tell me what attracted you to his work.
I've always loved noir, L.A. noir, books, movies, all of that. And the opportunity to not necessarily have everything I do be in the horror field, but still it's got a lot of suspense and those elements of noir,
right.
The darkness of character and the like that are so fascinating and compelling in a story, whether it's on a page or on a screen. And I met him once at a book fair, and it was right after I'd made The Stand, and he wanted me to option White Jazz. And White Jazz is an experimental novel, the writing of it as if a jazz musician was writing it, because it's a lot of incomplete sentences and bebop.
Oh, wow.
It's really a difficult movie.
What do you think made him think you would be right for that one?
Well, I think he was looking for anybody he met to make the movie out of it at the time, because it was such a tough thing to adapt that I did not pursue that.
Right.
It was made years later, and it was not a particularly good movie, so I might have dodged a bullet.
Yeah,
didn't regret it. But, you know, Ellroy's a fascinating character. He's hugely eccentric, and I think knows it, and his politics are all over the place weird.
Yeah. What was it about the book that you did want to do for him?
Well, Clandestine was actually optioned by Mark Sennett, who was my producer on a couple of the King miniseries.
Ah.
And so we actually were developing it. He'd had a script written, and then I was doing the rewrite, and we just couldn't get it set up. And now there are some pretty unsavory things about it that you couldn't make it today.
Right.
And I would gladly not make it today because of those elements.
Sure.
There are some very unseemly portrayals of gays and the like. And it's just an uncomfortable book to read. I reread it recently and thought, yeah, I'm really glad I didn't make that movie.
Yeah, yeah. It is amazing how much has changed even since the 90s.
Yeah.
Especially in terms of you know, tone and whatnot, and what you can say and can't say. And
a lot of it with very good reason.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Ian wants to know, speaking of things changing, Ian wants to know, what do you make of the Russo brothers' comments this week about developing feature films to be more like TikTok and pushing the narrative that theaters are dead to younger audiences, especially when there's been movies like Top Gun, Smile, Barbarian, and Terrifier 2 overperforming?
Well, I haven't read those. I don't read much of that stuff. But for people whose entire careers have benefited from giant screen marketed movies, it seems kind of silly to me.
Yeah.
And condescending and you know, okay, you guys make movies for TikTok for the rest of your career.
Sure.
But yeah. No, yeah. I don't know them. Yeah. Right. Other than
and by the way, for the record, neither do I.
Yes. The only Joe Russo I know is sitting in the room right here.
Yes.
And he's not a Marvel.
No, not. I mean, not that I wouldn't want to be, but yeah, I'm but, not yet.
But no, and so it's not really fair of me to give an opinion on something I haven't read. But if that is the gist of their comments, it just baffles me.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's odd to kind of proclaim that the box office, look, I mean, the last 2 years have been very hard for the movie theater theatrical business, right?
Yeah. But other than that, entire theatrical box office business has been dominated by them and Marvel.
Sure. Yeah. Before that. Absolutely. But yeah, it's weird to be like, hey, we're part of the reason that, it's harder to make money for smaller movies at the box office. Yeah. But I mean, you know, I mean, it, kind of looking at that and taking the pandemic out, I mean, it has been a pretty good year at the box office as the world is healing.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to be like, oh, wow, the original movies and smaller movies are dead, when literally this week, Smile just crossed $200 million.
Yeah. I mean, thank goodness movie theaters are there. Yes, they're hurting. They're not where they were. And part of that is because it was so dominated by event movies, the Marvel movies and Top Guns and event movies like that. But people seem to be returning to the theaters for the smaller films, mostly in the horror genre.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson last year kind of famously said during his press tour for Licorice Pizza that he was excited about a Spider-Man movie being big at the box office because it got people more comfortable with going back to the theaters again, and therefore they might open their hearts and wallets to something like a Licorice Pizza.
Yeah, and that's true. It does take a big hit movie that crosses all the quadrants to be able to get people into the habit of going to the movies again and remembering how much fun it can be to see a movie shared with an audience on a big, big screen.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my first movie back post-pandemic was seeing with you the premiere of the most recent Saw movie, Darren Bozeman's Spiral, the Book of Saw.
Right.
And I'll never forget, because it was like, you know, I basically felt like I was gripping my mask to my face to hold it tighter because there were so many people in the room and I hadn't been around that, you know, in quite some time. I mean, you had, I think, had the vaccine for a little while and you'd gone back to a couple movies, but that was my first experience. And like the idea of reaching my hand to popcorn and then putting it in my mouth was
not terrifying.
Terrifying.
Much more frightening than watching a Saw movie.
Yeah. Honestly, it would have been like a Saw gimmick for me to have experienced. But as I started to go back further and further, and I started to like figure out how to be comfortable with seeing movies during a pandemic, I got back into the habit. So yeah. So I guess I'm just saying, the point being, you know, I think it is a good thing that something like Top Gun came along, because I think it helped kind of lift up the box office for the rest of the summer.
Absolutely. And I mean, this all came out of the discussion of the Russo brothers, which I'll say again, I did not read and don't know, but I'm just completely baffled by the statement by people who've made a career of tentpole movies.
Yeah, I really do think, you know, they're basically the context of the quote was they don't think that Gen Z has the same relationship with theaters that their generation.
Well, that's true.
And that is true.
I don't argue with that. Yeah. If that's what they said, it is true. Younger people don't go to the movies as much as they used to.
Right.
They have access to movies on all their other devices, often day and date, that they're in the movie theaters.
But see, here's where I would push back on that theory. Because, you know, when you do see something like Smile and Barbarian, like Gen Z is going to those movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not just all older generations.
No, but not as much of Gen Z.
Sure.
You know, we used to have bigger turnouts for movies than we do now.
True. There is more competition for their attention. But I would also argue that, like, when I was growing up, that was the advent of VHS and DVD, right? And video games. And so,
they keep predicting the end of the movie theater. And with luck, they'll keep being wrong.
Yeah. And I guess that's my point is, like, I had plenty of distractions when I was a kid to keep me from going to movies. But I love the experience of going to movies. And I love seeing, I think everyone loves seeing a great movie in the theater with an audience.
Absolutely.
You know? And so I don't think that Gen Z is immune to that. I mean, we took my friend's 5-year-old to see E.T. this summer in the theater. And it blew his mind.
That's
so
great.
Yeah. So, you know.
And that's a movie from 40 years ago.
Absolutely. So I think, I think the weird thing is, like, the idea that Gen Z won't come to movies, I think, is a falsehood. I think they will come if you give them a great movie.
If you build it, they will come.
I think so. Yeah. I really do believe that. Well, on that note, Mick.
Yes.
another AMA in the books. We've got some exciting guests coming up through the end of the year. Excited to wrap up season...
Six seasons of Postmortem. Who
Good
knew?
Lord.
Who knew? Oh my God! Yep. We've done almost 140 interviews.
Incredible.
Something like that over the course of the 6 years, and we're still coasting along and having a good time with it. So
thank you,
Joe, and thanks for everybody out there.
And if you guys want to send us questions for our last couple Ask Mick Anythings for the season, for the year, you can send them to Mick on Twitter and Instagram at Mick Garris PM. You can also send them to me at Joe Russo Tweets and at Joe Russo Graham, respectively.
And even
and
more importantly,
we have an email, askmickanything@gmail.com.
So send us your questions and you can ask anything and I probably will answer.
Even if he takes issue with your username. All right. Thank
All
you, Mick.
Fun. Thanks, Joe.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.